Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Shutdowns and debt limits, Obamacare, oh my. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 25th of September. Great to have you with us, everybody. And this is where we are with 6 days left in fiscal 2013. We are nowhere. Republicans in the House have had their say on the federal budget. Democrats in the Senate will have their say at some point later this week. And it's pretty much guaranteed they are not going to be saying the same thing. So when push comes to shove next Monday at midnight, it's entirely possible that big chunks of the federal government are going to have to turn off the lights and lock the door. We've been here before, of course, most recently back in the mid-90s, twice then in point of fact. And contrary to what you might think, shutting things down doesn't save any money at all. Marketplace's David Gura gets us going.
We got an estimate of the cost of those shutdowns a couple of weeks after the second one ended, in January 1996.
Good morning.
President Clinton brought it up during his weekly radio address.
Two government shutdowns so far have cost taxpayers about $1.5 billion. $1.5 billion. That's not monopoly money.
Adjusting for inflation, that would be about $2 billion today.
That's probably a lowball estimate.
Nick Schwellenbach is an analyst with the Center for Effective Government. During those shutdowns, the EPA didn't assess or collect $60 million worth of fines. Small businesses couldn't bid on contracts valued at $244 million. Schwellenbach says that those costs don't even begin to include the inefficiencies associated with a government shutdown.
The leadership of many of these agencies that would rather be spending their time executing their agency's mission are actually spending a lot of time right now trying to prepare for potential shutdowns.
Time, which of course costs money. In the 90s, Ron Haskins was a Republican staffer for a House subcommittee.
There are lots of practical implications on people in their, their normal life, but also on the American economy.
Haskins says it can affect GDP and the government's ability to hire and keep good workers.
It's a lousy way to run a country, to close down the government and create all this uncertainty, plus some very specific costs.
Plus some other costs that are harder to quantify, what are called opportunity costs, the value of all the time and resources we put into having this debate over and over again. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Here with the latest from the world of Obamacare, which not coincidentally at all with the budget fight, also has the 1st of October highlighted in red. That's when the federally operated insurance exchanges start up. And today we got a price list of sorts for those exchanges. And some of them do look to be pretty good deals. A 27-year-old woman in Dallas, just for instance, who makes about $25,000 a year, could buy one of the lowest cost insurance plans for $74 a month. But with insurance, as with so many things in life, the opening price is just the beginning. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the health desk at WHYY.
Let's say next week you're shopping for coverage on one of the new exchanges.
You think you get a really sweet deal on health insurance.
But Georgetown's Sabrina Corlett says what looks like a sweet deal may not be.
The premium is just one dimension of your health insurance cost.
You've also got your deductibles, the amount you pay up front before your coverage fully kicks in, which can run into the thousands. Then there are copays, 20 or 30 bucks each time you see the doctor, provided the one you need is in your network.
If you need to get specialty care that's outside of that network, you may have to pay more.
And prescription costs, which can be brutal.
It's thousands of dollars to a consumer.
Dan Mendelson is the CEO of Avalir Health, which released a study today on out-of-pocket costs for policies offered on some of the exchanges. Mendelson says it's quite possible people will wind up paying more for medication than for their monthly premiums.
Our research has shown that patients who face these very high deductibles often abandon their prescriptions at the point of sale.
Even patients with cancer would skip their medication, Mendelson says, if they have to pay more than $500. The Affordable Care Act does have annual spending caps of $6,400 for an individual, $12,800 for a family, and most of the policies on the exchange qualify for federal subsidies. But if you can't afford all the extras, your insurance might not be worth much, no matter how cheap your monthly premium. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Wall Street today? Yeah, no. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We could, if we wanted to, do economic statistics all the live long day, quote, numbers and percentages and analysis until the cows come home. That, however, is not good radio, so we try to keep that kind of thing to a minimum. But there is one piece of data that pretty well sums up where we are right now as an economy, something called the labor force participation rate. The percentage of Americans either working or actively looking for work is the lowest it's been in 35 years. People of all ages are dropping out of the workforce, but one group stands out: women of the baby boom. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Back in 2007, economists at the Bureau of Labor Statistics made a very well-researched prediction of how many people would be in the workforce right now. Just one thing they didn't predict: the Great Recession, which knocked 4 million people who had planned to be working right out of the workforce. They're not in jobs now, and they're not looking for jobs either. Heidi Shierholz at the Economic Policy Institute has crunched the numbers.
Most of the missing workers over the age of 55, around 500,000, most of those are women.
So 500,000 missing baby boomer women. They got laid off or quit in the downturn. Shierholz says it's hard for them to get re-employed.
Right now, because of the weak job opportunities, they are doing something else. And we don't know a whole lot about what they're doing.
So where have all the older women gone? Some of them are here at a local community college in Portland, Oregon.
There's a great book. It's called The 225 Best Jobs for the Baby Boomers.
The college hosts a program for job seekers over 50. Part support group, part how to look younger for your next interview.
If you haven't upgraded your glasses in a while, go get that. There's, you know, places you can go. Very inexpensive to have done.
Several of the women in the class have given up even looking for work over the last few years. Chris Clothier's 65, living alone. She took a buyout from a government job and figured she'd find something else to boost her retirement account.
I really thought I could get a data entry job relatively easily, part-time. You know, I figured somebody would need me.
No such luck.
The interviews for the grocery store jobs were like, how will you be supportive of people who come into the store and everything? And totally understand that they want super friendly, super good people. And yet at 65, there's a part of me that just goes, why am I doing this? Trying to fit myself into somebody else's mold.
Several women in the class had taken time out after being laid off to care for elderly parents. And Heidi Shierholz points out that some of the missing boomer women are okay with not working anymore.
Not everybody in this pool of missing workers is completely unhappy.
I almost wish I didn't have to go back to work because I was very busy, you know, doing my own thing all day.
That's Carol Schroeder. She's 65, lives in suburban New York, and was laid off from her secretarial job 2.5 years ago. She just landed a part-time job, data entry.
I'm not really excited about it. I'm excited about the money because we've really been strapped. We recently had our 26th wedding anniversary, and my husband said we're going to blow $100, and that's just the way it was. And I had lobster, and he had steak. But, you know, we don't do that maybe once or twice a year.
Schroeder only plans to work until her husband retires next year, which doesn't surprise career counselor Minda Redburn. She says many boomer women grew up not expecting to work their whole lives, even though they worked much more than their own mothers.
If they don't have to work financially, why would they? It's not as important to them in terms of self-image to have a job as it is to their male counterparts.
Chris Clothier thinks if the only jobs women her age can find are a big step down, they won't stick with them.
I think men have always been raised to be the quote-unquote provider, and so they're going to stick with a job no matter what till the end. And I think women perhaps have less tolerance for that.
And guess what? More men in that 55 to 64 age bracket have stayed on the job than economists expected. They're trying to squeeze out every last dime from working before they finally retire. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You've got a couple of options if you hear something on this program that you like, or that you hate, for that matter. You could email us, you could hit us up on Twitter at MarketplaceAPM, or you could go to our website, marketplace.org, and leave a comment. But there's the rub, because comment sections on journalism sites can be painful, often hijacked by trolls who knock down pretty much everything they read. And that, in part, helps explain why Popular Science has shut down its comment section. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill reports.
Hey, all you internet trolls, I know you aren't much for nuance and subtlety, so let me speak slowly and in words you might understand. People who care about civilization hate you. Your predictable, boring diatribes are ruining the internet for the rest of us. Get a job. All right, I'm done. Retha Hill is a professor at Arizona State University's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism.
Commenting has gotten really out of control with a lot of nasty comments, with arguments, with everything going to political.
It doesn't matter what the story is, she says. It can be anything and can get ugly.
People really go after each other in a way that discourages really good, thoughtful conversation.
Popular Science, for its part, has had enough anti-science bashers and political railing. It's closing its comment section down. Suzanne Labar is Popular Science's online content director.
This research came out a few months ago that showed that how people perceive science is actually shaped in part by comment sections.
And that, she says,
was all the motivation that we needed to just finally end it.
Labar says they want to be a safe place for science, a place where people can form smart opinions, so policymakers can form smart opinions and help the right things get funded. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Should I become insufferable on the topic of global poverty, folklore, the human genome, plant life, algebra, or better yet, the entire world?
So many MOOCs, so little time. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 61 points today, about 0.4%, closed at 15,273. The NASDAQ off 7 points, about 0.2%. 3761. The S&P 500 shed 4 points, 0.25%, ended things at 1692. Walmart was whipsawed by a Bloomberg report that said the world's biggest retailer had cut orders from suppliers. The company called that report inaccurate. Nonetheless, shares finished the day down almost 1.5%. The cost for JPMorgan Chase to settle a welter of government investigations is reported to be climbing. And in the way these things work, and stock prices climbing too. Go figure. The bank shares gained 2.75% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.62%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. A look at the housing market. The National Association of Realtors issues its pending home sales index for August. A conference at the National Press Club focuses on preparing the nation for flu season. I know, you've probably still got your summer tan. Time flies. And on September 26, 1969, the Brady Bunch premiered. Marsha, 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 I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Sioux Falls, South Dakota got some time in the national media spotlight a couple of weeks ago here, in point of fact, as the first stop of our new project with Jim Fallows of The Atlantic and his wife, Deb. They're flying around the country in their own small plane, one engine, four seats, with us joining them along the way in a series we're calling American Futures.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo, got Tango for landing.
It's all about what America and the American economy look like right now from places in this country that don't usually get a whole lot of attention. Jim and Deb's latest stop is Burlington, Vermont, population about 42,000 or so. Hey, Jim, good to talk to you again.
Kai, nice to talk to you. It's been a long time since Sioux Falls.
I was just going to say, it's been a while. So listen, I want to start actually with Sioux Falls. When we flew in there a month, whatever it was, ago, we talked a lot about how you can tell things from the air as you approach these towns and cities with small airports. What does Burlington, Vermont, look like from the air? What was the approach?
When we were in Sioux Falls, we saw the expanse of the plains all around us. We could see all the sort of transportation hubs. You see that Burlington is right on Lake Champlain, but otherwise is sort of isolated from main transport areas. It's in the mountains of Vermont. And so they had to find some way to create an economy there without those advantages of transportation or much farmland, really.
Well, let's pick up on that then, because one of the things about Sioux Falls was how it connected back to us, whether it was agriculture or, and by us, I mean everybody, agriculture or food or what have you. What struck you about Burlington that makes the connection to the rest of the American economy and the rest of the people out here?
Well, we won't even talk about Ben & Jerry's, but I think the main example would be a company called Dealer.com, which makes most of the software that auto dealers around the country and increasingly around the world use to price their vehicles. Mm-hmm. They even are going to put on an app soon that's supposed to take the place of that horrible stage in the car dealership where the dealer writes down a number and says he's going to go check with the manager. Another example is a company called Renewable NRG Systems, which makes essentially the machinery and software for the worldwide expansion in wind turbine power. It's part of an interesting sort of technological heritage there. There was an IBM plant right near Burlington, started in the 1960s, mm-hmm. and people who originally moved there to work at IBM, their descendants, their friends, have stayed to create a little tech empire. They now have sales in more than 150 countries around the world, and they manufacture all of their equipment right outside Burlington. Vermont.
You know, that's funny because Burlington, Vermont is not what I or maybe a lot of people would think of as a place where technology companies flourish.
There is a particular kind of recruitment approach you need to use when you're not in one of the major national talent hubs like Silicon Valley or mm-hmm. like Los Angeles or New York or Boston or whatever. They found a way to sort of screen early for people who had some kind of connection to Vermont who thought this would be a good place to live their lives.
All right. I want to talk for a second about beer, Jim.
well, if you twist my arm.
I know, right? You have found or have been told about what is allegedly the best beer in America, this thing called Heady Topper from the Alchemist Brewery. Tell me, first of all, about it and why it's and they're the way they sell, which is to me the most incredible part.
There's a kind of magical unicorn quality to Heady Topper. Anybody who's interested in beer has known about this for a long time, but also not had it, because essentially you can't buy it not only outside the state of Vermont, but outside sort of northern Vermont. So in pursuit of journalistic excellence, I drove the 20 miles or so from Burlington to the little town of Waterbury, and I saw this brewery where one after another, I would see generally males between the age of, say, 21 and 45, staggering out of this the brewery with a case of these silver cans apiece, because there's a limit of buying one case per customer. The stores where they authorize sales of these things, they have little posters in the window saying, you know, our heady topper arrives Wednesday at 1 p.m.
Wow.
And loyalists know if you get there after like 2:30, it's gone.
Wow. That's crazy. All right. Now I have
to, so if I can lure you to
Burlington. I was
just going to
say, now I have to go to Vermont. All right. James Fallows from The Atlantic and our project, American Futures. We will see you out on the road at some point, Jim.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Got to get me some of that beer, man. Our series is called American Futures. It lives online at marketplace.org. We've got maps, Jim's blog from The Atlantic, even a little quiz up today about Burlington and the great state of Vermont. Take a minute while you're there as well. Tell us where we ought to go next. As chaotic as things have been in Syria, they got just that much more difficult today. 13 rebel groups now say they don't recognize the authority of the Western-backed Syrian National Coalition. But while the geopolitics work themselves out, as many as 2 million Syrians have run away. They've taken refuge in neighboring countries, which are now struggling to find homes for them and jobs as well. And the welcome that those refugees got at first has started to wear thin, as Kimberly Adams reports from Cairo.
Mayis El-Shami and Ayman El-Nasser are two young men in their 20s. Both work in the same neighborhood in the Cairo suburb of 6th of October City. It's a bustling shopping district full of cafes, fast food restaurants, and clothing stores. But they are part of two increasingly divided communities. El-Shami is 25 and a Syrian refugee. His family transplanted their sandwich shop from war-ravaged Daraa in southern Syria to a busy street here in this lively district.
As soon as we came to Egypt, the treatment was really good and we were happy and we didn't feel homesick. But after June 30th, everything turned upside down.
June 30th was when massive street protests started that led to President Mohamed Morsi being booted from office. Morsi was a strong supporter of the Syrian opposition. But when he was deposed, there was a backlash against Syrian refugees in Egypt. Some of that backlash was political, but some was economic. 26-year-old Egyptian Ayman El-Nasser works just around the corner from El-Shami's sandwich shop and says his perspective on Syrian refugees working here has changed.
The situation is different now. The Egyptian people don't get any benefit from them. Syrians have started begging here in Egypt, and they want any kind of job they can get. Now, Egyptian shop owners are hiring Syrians instead of Egyptians, so the percentage of unemployed youth like me increases.
El-Nasser has a college degree, but says he can't get any work other than a part-time job carrying charcoal for water pipes at an outdoor cafe. The Egyptian government estimates there are at least 300,000 Syrian refugees here right now, increasing competition as the country struggles with more than 13% unemployment. That tension is making things harder for those trying to help the refugees start a new life.
I think the access to employment now would be increasingly difficult.
Mohamed Dairi is the regional representative for the United Nations Refugee Agency. He thinks, hopes, this backlash against Syrian workers is just temporary.
We have got to see things cooling down, and hopefully that the environment would change favorably in Egypt so that Syrians would recover the open arms and the support that they had enjoyed.
Many Egyptians in the 6th of October district still do support the refugees. They point out how they boost the real estate market and open new businesses. But part-time coffee shop worker El-Nasser doesn't see that as a good thing. His hands are covered in charcoal dust from his low-wage job keeping the bubbling water pipes hot, and he resents the competition the Syrians have brought in jobs and in business.
We used to be considered the biggest coffee shop in 6th of October. Now look over there where the Syrians open one, and all of them are there.
Preparing sandwiches nearby, Syrian refugee El-Shami complains that Egyptian customers have become more hostile, and he faces discrimination in the streets. He says he's done with Egypt.
We left our country because of dignity, to preserve our dignity, not to be offended. And even here, we came with our money, but we find a country that respects us.
El-Shami once planned to settle in Egypt and get married. Now he says he doesn't know where he'll go. Most of his family has left Egypt already and gone back to Syria. In Cairo, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Remember when back to school really only applied to kids? Yeah, that was then. Now, with all the free massive open online courses, MOOCs in the vernacular, anybody can be a student. Retirees, soccer moms, radio commentators. Here's Beth Tytel.
Last fall, in the grip of a self-improvement fit, I realized that a MOOC was just the thing to turn me into a fascinating and sought-after dinner party guest. But which MOOC? Should I become insufferable on the topic of global poverty, folklore, the human genome, plant life, algebra, or better yet, the entire world? I registered for the History of the World since 1300. It was taught by a Princeton professor, and I imagine the new me dropping references to the Mongol invasion and the role the environment played in the crises of the 14th century. I had just decided to buy a Princeton scrunchie, they sell those, when a small problem emerged. The class started. And suddenly, there was a textbook I was supposed to read, lectures I needed to watch, essays I had to write. It was like college all over again, but this time complicated by a full-time job, my children, and Netflix. I never did manage to catch that first lecture, or any subsequent ones. The weekly letters from the professor sat in my inbox, haunting me, like a thank you note I hadn't written. After a semester of pain, the email ceased, and I decided to scale back my goals. Maybe I'd try Pilates. But last week, there it was, another email from Coursera, the online education company. Beth Tytel, we have recommended courses for you. I should have hit delete, but I'm not that strong. I'm Al Pacino in The Godfather 3. Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in.
Beth Tytel is a reporter for the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, prompted by this line I saw crawling across the bottom of the screen on Bloomberg Television earlier today. Quote, Larry Ellison skips Oracle Open World for America's Cup Final, end quote. That is, a highly paid corporate CEO skipped the premier conference for his company's products so he could go sailing on San Francisco Bay. Turned out all right for him, though. Ellison's Oracle Team USA capped off an amazing comeback today in the America's Cup to win the oldest trophy in sports, which is good because he spent like a couple of $100 million to do it, you know. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Carlos Asensio, Robbie Carmen, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.